From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, she's a Michigan delegate to the GOP convention, and she does not want to see Donald Trump become the nominee.
Watching speeches, and he's dropping F-bombs at rallies, and I have great concerns about my children and who they're looking up to as a role model.
Two Detroiters fight back against outsiders who dump trash in their neighborhood. Pick up a camera and put the dumpers on YouTube.
You know, I'm not trying to escalate a situation. I'm trying to get it to stop.
The next idea, get your creative juices flowing, whether from improv or just a good walk.
So many creative people, from Beethoven to Steve Jobs to Charles Dickens, Virginia Woolf, love to walk and get ideas.
Those stories and much more for you today on Stateside. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Good to have you with us today. The group trying to legalize marijuana in Michigan, it's taking its fight to court after state authorities rejected the group's petition drive. Later in the hour, we talk with the attorney that is leading the group suing the state to get the marijuana question on the November ballot. But first, there's a growing sense among Republicans that their party needs someone at the top of the ticket who is not Donald Trump. And Donald Trump is noticing.
We're going to beat Hillary. And it would be helpful if the Republicans could help us a little bit, you know.
One of those who does not want to help Donald Trump even a little bit is my next guest, Wendy Day, who will be a Michigan delegate to the Republican convention in Cleveland next month. She does not want to cast her vote for Donald Trump. Wendy Day, why is that?
Well, you know, first of all, I was elected to cast my vote for Ted Cruz on the first ballot, and we'll be doing that. But beyond that, you know, I have great concerns about Donald Trump as a nominee for the Republican Party. And while I want to beat Hillary Clinton in November, his double-digit, you know, current polling below her is not really encouraging that he's going to be able to pull that off in November. So if we want to win in November, I think we need to have a candidate that actually is going to fundraise and that actually can beat her. And I'm not sure he can.
So what are you and others opposed to Trump hoping to do next month in Cleveland?
Well, you know, there's a lot of different movements out there, and really it's been a loose network of delegates and folks talking. One of the things they're working on is a conscientious objection clause. We have delegates who are elected a year before the candidate who was going to be the potential nominee became evident, and now they're faced with someone who really doesn't represent the platform consistently. He has never voted in a Republican primary. He, you know, skipped debates, and he's not even committed to coming to convention, as far as I can tell. So they have some grave concerns and want the opportunity to vote their conscience at convention, which is what they're elected to do ultimately.
So you basically are hoping to change convention rules so you could free the bound delegates from being forced to vote for Donald Trump on the first ballot. But what about that backlash? Because the fact is, you've seen Donald Trump pretty much sweeping the Republican primaries. So we know what GOP voters are thinking, and they seem to be supporting him.
Well, actually, he didn't sweep the GOP primaries,
you got to admit, he pretty much did.
No, actually, he didn't, because and this really isn't about one candidate. But Senator Cruz got 7 million votes, and when he funded his campaign, Trump had 10 million votes. Trump did very well in open primary states. He did very poorly in closed primary or convention states. So I think that's a misnomer. Now, he's gotten 14 million votes now, but most of those, you know, or many of those came after he was the only candidate that was, you know, had not suspended their campaign. And the reality is we know that he was not elected by the majority of Republican primary voters, Republican Party members. He just wasn't. And in fact, there was a large percentage in the Republican Party that opposed him and chose other candidates over him because he does not have a proven track record of being committed to the Republican platform.
But you want to change the rules.
Well, that's what they're going for. I'm not on the Rules Committee, so I don't get to change the rules. But there are folks in the Rules Committee that are trying to add that rule so that folks can vote their conscience. At the end of the day, whether we are successful or not, most people know that the only language Trump speaks is one of transaction. If you have something he wants, he is willing to be the art of the deal maker and communicate with you. Once you've given him what he wants, he doesn't care about that anymore and doesn't have any use for you. So as a conservative going into convention, worst case scenario, at least maybe we'd have some leverage and influence to protect that platform and to protect, you know, who we choose as vice president. But we're not going to have any of that if we roll over and just, you know, go along to get along right now.
Wendy, I know you manage the Michigan campaign for Senator Ted Cruz. Is your kind of getting on board with this no Trump effort more about helping Senator Cruz win a nomination, or are you thinking in terms of what a Trump nomination would mean for the Republican Party and also the down ballot GOP candidates?
That's a great question, and we've talked about that a lot, and it really is not about one candidate. In fact, no candidates are really being talked about right now. It is really about who I am as a Republican. You know, I don't want Donald Trump's version of what a Republican is to become the standard bearer for what I believe, because he's not, and it doesn't. You know, I'm a military wife and a military mom, and I think about the president, what their job is when it comes to the military and when it comes to reaching out to families. And let's say, you know, God forbid my husband was killed. You know, is Donald Trump someone I would want a phone call from? Is he a statesman who could handle those situations with grace and kindness and love? And I have not seen that from him. And so I have great concerns about that. You know, I have great concerns about my children, you know, again, watching speeches and he's dropping F-bombs at rallies. And I have great concerns about my children and who they're looking up to as a role model. So I want a statesman.
Who do you see as a viable alternative candidate if indeed this dump Trump movement at the convention takes root?
You know, I'm not sure. And I hate throwing out names because then it becomes this guy or this guy. But I can tell you this. You know, I'm getting heat from both party faithful, which is fine, and then also from the people who love Trump to get on board with this effort. So it really isn't one or the other. It's both. And so, you know, I'm really resistant to putting out a candidate. But I can say that this is not some secret effort in any one direction. What I won't support, and I'm quite serious about this, what I won't support is going to the mat for this issue and, you know, putting us out there, delegates and myself included, to end up with someone who is going to sell us out or be kind of a milquetoast candidate. I'm not interested in that. But I don't have any idea what's going to happen. We just have to get to convention and see.
That will be very, very interesting. Wendy Day will be a delegate from Michigan to what will be a very, very interesting, to put it mildly, GOP convention next month in Cleveland. Wendy, thanks so much for talking with us today.
Glad to be here.
Tomorrow is a day to celebrate music and the people who make it. It's called Make Music Detroit. The city joins over 700 cities in 120 countries in holding a Make Music Day. Mike Wu is with Make Music Detroit. Welcome to Stateside.
Thanks for having me.
So this is part of basically a national musical holiday?
In certain countries, it is a national music holiday. It started in France in 1982, and since then, over half of the population participates, and it's now a national holiday in France.
So this is the first time Detroit is taking part of it. What is the goal of Make Music Detroit?
Provide access to performance space and music education to people of all ages. The basic premise of all Make Music Days is it has to be free, has to be easily accessible to the public. All genres are accepted. Anyone that would like to perform, learn, or teach are allowed to.
Tell us what's happening tomorrow.
Well, tomorrow we will have over 150 performances at over 20 different venues around the city. There will be workshops being conducted as well. This is the inaugural year, so we would like to introduce the event to the city and have the visitors and the music makers of the city just get to know each other and just have fun and just celebrate music along with the rest of the world.
Give us an idea of some of the artists you've got lined up.
For this year, we really wanted to showcase the eclectic and vibrant sounds of the city. So we have Liz Lahren, a winner of a 33 Detroit Music Awards, RJ Spangler Quintet featuring sax legend Larry Smith and Nikki Pierce, Philharmonic Sextet featuring Queen of Soul Thornetta Davis, Kevin Reynolds from the 2016 Metro Times Reader's Choice Best Electronic Artist, Amp Fiddler, The Mighty Funhouse featuring Skeeto Valdez, Paul Randolph, and John Douglas.
So you've really got this, like you say, all genres. You've got the bases covered.
We really wanted to make sure that the music is a true representation of the city. Granted, this is the first year, and we haven't covered, you know, all of it because there are so many different musical genres, but we have a wide range of musicians that have signed up, and it's been overwhelming.
And as you say, over 20 different venues, so probably the best thing that anyone who wants to hear some music should do is go to makemusicdetroit.org, because you've got the performance schedules and times and information on the artists. That's all in there, so people can kind of plan a day of music.
And as well, there's also a Make Music app that people can download that will have the schedule and the venue locations and a map.
Now, bringing all these people together and getting all these venues, it's got to be a huge, huge undertaking. Where's the money coming from? Who's underwriting all of this?
Larry King, the founder, was first introduced to this at a Music City conference and thought it would be a great event for the city. He thought Detroit would be a perfect place for it, and initially wanted to plan for it next year. However, the Make Music Alliance kind of convinced us to start it this year. It has been a big undertaking, so Larry is basically funding this out of his pocket.
And again, anyone who wants to go, it is wide open. It's free, right?
It's free. It's all ages. Everything would be age appropriate. And we want to highlight the vital role music and music education plays in promoting better social, academic, and spiritual engagement. Early exposure to music, especially with youth, is something that's indispensable for a children's future. Whether they go into any creative arts or math and science, everything takes some sort of a creative mentality. And having early exposure to music kind of preps the kids for adversity and like problem solving, spatial intelligence, and even, you know, studies have shown that early exposure to music helps with learning new languages. People do better academically, especially in math and vocabulary. So we're really trying to have this as the foundation of our objective and mission.
Well, parents who have kids home on summer vacation and are going, what am I going to do with the kids today? Here's a great idea. 12 hours of music from noon to midnight. Make Music Detroit Day. And you can get all the details at makemusicdetroit.org. Mike Wu, thanks so much for sharing with us.
Thank you very much for having us. And we hope to see you tomorrow.
This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty.
Creation.
Entrepreneurship.
The next idea.
We have to make room for this ability to learn to be creative.
What drives innovation? What's the internal fire that lights us up and gets those creative juices flowing? Our latest contributor to The Next Idea thinks the answer could lie in improv games like Yes And, or perhaps in juggling. Dr. David Fessel is a professor of radiology at the University of Michigan. Welcome. Good to have you with us, Doctor.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Well, The Next Idea is a series all about innovation, and that's a word that to me brings to mind technology and STEM and hard work and probably not so much improv comedy and juggling. What's the scientific connection between these brain functions?
Yes, there's so many cool things going on now with technology being merged with creativity to show us really what's going on inside the brain when people are creative. We've been able to put rappers and poets and jazz improvisers into the MR scanner, the magnetic resonance scanner, and see what's actually going on in their brain while they're being creative. And it's giving us insights that we've never been able to show or learn from before.
What do you see when they're in there? What's happening?
It's so exciting. People who are trained in these arts don't have different brains than the rest of us. They just use them in slightly different ways. They're able to dial down those filters that filter out the thoughts and that say, oh, don't say that, don't even think that. They're able to dial down those filters and dial up the creativity filters a little bit more. That's really the big difference that we're seeing so far. So it's not a different brain. It's just them using it with practice and with experience a little bit differently.
So firing up creativity means dropping and dialing down the self-consciousness,
yes.
the overly self-awareness,
inhibition. Yeah, those kind of things. Yes, exactly.
Well, as I read in your essay for The Next Idea, you were the guy that colored inside the lines and you checked all the boxes. And we know how grueling a medical education is. How'd you change and why?
A lot of years of school, a lot of labs, a lot of libraries, a lot of late night studying, checking off those boxes, jumping through those hoops. And then I realized one day that in my work and teaching at the University of Michigan, I'm in front of an audience and I was really nervous. I was really anxious. And a friend of mine had done some improv comedy classes. He said, why don't you give it a try? I thought, okay, I'll just do a summer class, see what it's like. I did one class and I was hooked. I kept going for 2 years straight. Second City, Detroit, before it closed. And it was transformative for me.
Why?
I realized I could have fun in front of an audience. I didn't have to be self-conscious, that I could relax. I could focus on the people there and what I had to give rather than worrying about me or how I might screw up or what mistake I might make. That doesn't really matter. What matters is what we're there to give.
And then how did that affect your work, your lecturing, and the work you're doing?
So much more comfortable in front of an audience, knowing I could have fun with them in a meeting at work. And because of the improv, these ideas get loosened up. The filters get dialed down a little bit differently. And I think of something and I make a comment, people crack up. Where did that come from? It's the improv in relationships. I really think it helped me open and helped me meet and marry a really wonderful woman.
Well, one of the things you talked about in your next idea essay was that idea of word games to spark creativity. And one example is something called One Word Story. And I decided, all right, we're going to play it. But in order for us to really get a sense of it, we're bringing in Kate and Carl, our production interns. So we're all going to try to do this together. So you get to lead the class.
Yes, this will be fun. So we're going to create a story, one word at a time. A story that's never, ever been told before. So let's jump right into it.
Awesome.
Once.
There.
Was.
A.
Little.
Boy.
Who.
Loved.
Climbing.
Rocks.
In.
The.
Park.
Where.
He.
Went.
Every.
Day.
To.
Go.
As.
A.
Pirate.
Because.
He.
Loved.
Ships.
And.
Panning.
Hooks.
In.
I lost the word. See, I'm becoming too aware. Did you say panning?
Panning, yes.
Panning. Hooks.
In.
In the.
Sea.
Where.
He.
Fell.
Once.
Into.
A shark? A.
That's okay. It happens. What's the word?
Very.
Deep.
Dark.
Mysterious.
Scary.
Whole.
Where?
He.
Laughed.
Forever.
And.
He.
Never.
Ever.
Looked.
Back.
Yes. There we go. All right. I like it. The fun thing about that story is you can't anticipate. You think it's going one way and the person before you says something totally different. So on the fly, you have to be creative and it forces you in a very fun, playful way to just pull out those creative things and get those creative juices flowing.
And I can imagine as arts educators are hearing us talk, people all over the state listening going, yeah, see, it works. But arts education is one of the first things that usually gets cut in our schools because of budget trouble. So in your view, does that kind of creativity need to be in schools or is this something that can be an individual journey like the one you took?
It can do it both ways. Both ways. It'd be great if it's in schools. And if it's not, for whatever reason, do it with a neighborhood group. Do it with a club. If you're a mom, hey, have the neighborhood kids over and play this as you drink Kool-Aid outside on a warm summer day or have popsicles. Or do it with your community group. Look up improv games online and have some fun.
Yeah, because there's another one called Yes And. How do you do that just to give people an idea of something to do when instead of just gossiping when they're all sitting around together?
Oh, yes. So you could do this as a play and acting out and somebody starts with a scene and the next person just rolls with it. You know, you're my mom. Yes. Hey, mom, what are we having for dinner tonight? And you just go with it and let the scene roll and unfold and develop. It's sort of like the one-word story, only acting it out in a scene.
And you also offer in your essay for the next idea some other things. For example, if an improv class or you've learned to juggle, that's something else you talked about. If that's not an option for someone, what are some ways to kind of things to do every day that can get those juices going?
Yes. One simple thing that everyone can do that costs nothing is going for a simple walk. Two researchers at Stanford love to walk and talk and get ideas, talk about their research. And one day they said, hey, why don't we study if walking actually makes us more creative, as it seems to do. So they did. They did a really well-controlled study out of Stanford. A simple 8-minute walk increases your creativity. Walking inside is good, even on a treadmill. Walking outside is even better. So many creative people, from Beethoven to Steve Jobs to Charles Dickens, Virginia Woolf, love to walk and get ideas. They gave that as one of their secrets of their creativity, and now we know it's real.
And it doesn't necessarily have to be the power walk because I'm trying to, you know, get in shape or get my, it's
a simple stroll, gentle stroll. Yes, outside is a little bit more stimulation because of nature, because of the sun, the wind, the sounds, but inside works too. get yourself moving, go for a walk, and your creative juices will flow.
And you mentioned meditation.
Meditation. There's so many health benefits of meditation. And certain types of meditation also have been shown to increase our creativity. Certain type called open monitoring meditation, where you just not are focusing on a mantra or a word or a sound. Those type of meditations are great. And if you do them, keep doing it, it's great. But a specific type where it's open monitoring is really, really helpful for creativity. There's an app called Headspace, and this is an example from the Headspace app. If your mind is the road and your thoughts are the cars, the open monitoring is watching the cars on the road, watching your thoughts come into your mind and float by like clouds in the sky, seeing what's going and watching them come, watching them go, just being an observer of your thoughts.
So you're not actively going, no, bad thought, go away.
No, not at all.
Everything's good. It's all good.
It's just a quiet acceptance and observation of what's going on in your own mind. And that has been shown to help those creative juices flow and help them percolate up to the surface.
And what do you think, Doctor, that all of this could mean in terms of moving Michigan forward, our economy, our government, our institutions, or our lives?
Yes, people are our strength. So if we can make our people, help them be more creative, have more creative tools in their tool belt, then our state and our economy and our lives will improve. I have no doubt about that.
Dr. David Fessel is a professor of radiology at the University of Michigan. You will find his essay on the Next Idea page at michiganradio.org. And as always, we welcome your comments there or on Michigan Radio's Facebook page or on Twitter at NextIdeaMI. Thank you so much for reminding us that it's a cool thing and a good thing to play.
Thank you so much. My pleasure.
Support for the Next Idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities. MichiganBusiness.org.
Today marks the start of summer, which means nice, lazy weeks of summer reading beckon, and a day at the beach has to include a book. So here's a suggestion for a beach read, The Charm Bracelet by Viola Shipman, perfect because it's set in the fictional Michigan beach town of Scoops. The Charm Bracelet tells the story of three generations of women from a family finding ways to connect all through a charm bracelet. Viola Shipman is the pen name for author Wade Rouse. He lives in West Michigan, and there's a pretty good story behind that pen name as well. Welcome to Stateside.
Thanks for having me.
So what is the journey of discovery that these three women are on in the Charm Bracelet?
Well, the journey was truly inspired by my grandmothers and their charm bracelets, as well as their lives and lessons. And what I wanted to do was write a novel that reminded people in this era where we're fighting so much over politics and other things of what's most important in life. And those are the things my grandmothers taught me, and that the grandmother in this novel teaches her daughter and granddaughter. And that's, you know, family, faith, fun, love, and a passion for what you do in this world.
Tell us a little about the three main women in your book, Lolly, Arden, and Lauren.
Yeah, Lolly is the matriarch of the Lindsay family, and she is this larger-than-life wig-wearing woman who works in a fudge shop in the fictional town of Scoops. And she is battling early signs of dementia, but still really lives in the moment. And she wants to reconnect with her daughter, Arden, who's this harried magazine writer in Chicago, and granddaughter, Lauren, who is a college senior who is on a path to be a business major but truly wants to be an artist. And both are kind of lost.
And before we go any further, with a nod to grandmothers, you have to tell us about your pen name.
Yeah, the pen name Viola Shipman is my maternal grandmother's name, and I wanted to pay tribute to my grandmothers, not only for inspiring this novel, but also for me to become a writer and also, I think, the person that I am today. And I also chose it because I wanted to pay tribute to all of our elders. I think that we've lost a little bit of connection with those whose sacrifices helped make us the people we are. So it means a lot to me that the publisher supported me in choosing a pen name for my first novel.
I love that. And I don't feel like I'm an elder, but I am a grandmother. So I love anything that has to do with making sure that those generational ties stay strong.
That's nice. You know, I spent almost every summer with my grandparents, and, you know, I got to know them not only as my grandparents, but as truly extraordinary people. So I'm really proud of that.
Now, how does a charm bracelet lead these women on this journey?
The grandmother in the story, Lolly, grew up having a charm bracelet that was passed along to her by her own mother, and she continues to send charms to her daughter and granddaughter, but they've kind of pushed the trinkets aside as seemingly meaningless and a little bit overly sentimental. And what the grandmother wants to do is remind them that, you know, these are really truly links to her past and her family's past. And they tell stories of, you know, who they are and how they got to be the people that they are today.
Why did you set this in a little Michigan beach town? I guess I'm wondering about what is the importance of Michigan and that lake setting to your story?
Well, I live just outside of Saugatuck Douglas, and I moved to Michigan 10 years ago from St. Louis, and I fell totally head over heels in love with the beauty of the state, as well as the people. And, you know, entire coast of Michigan is so inspiring, and I am inspired every single day when I write and I visit the beach. And, you know, I don't leave Saugatuck or West Michigan in the summer. I just kind of tour all the little resort towns. So I wanted to pay, you know, tribute to the beauty of the state.
Well, would you read us a little bit from the charm bracelet? And this is a part where the granddaughter, Lauren, steps out in the morning and is ready to get her painting going again. Could you read us a section?
Sure. The morning light shimmered through the trees and gave the lake an otherworldly hue. Everything in this Michigan world seemed to have a soft shimmer to it, as though God had hung gauze over the sky and softly scattered glitter on all his creations. A little more gold, white, blue, Lauren considered. This simple little lake was filled with so much beauty. It's the light, my grandmother always told me. It's the magical light, Lauren thought. Scoops, Michigan sat along the 45th parallel north, a circle of latitude often called the halfway point between the equator and the North Pole. Some of the world's most stunning vistas rested along this line, and they were considered by many to be not only spiritual spots, but also places of incomparable beauty. At this latitude, the sun stayed in the summer sky in these parts of northern Michigan for nearly 18 hours. Artists believe the angle of the sun and the magical light it produced made the world glow. Artists traveled from around the world to paint here for decades, and local galleries housed in former barns now dotted the lakeshore. Art collectors in smart spectacles, linen pants, and silk scarves came to Scoops from across the country every summer, snatching up works both by famed and yet-to-be-discovered talent. Farmers and vintners had followed the artists in recent years. Vineyards and wineries set along rolling hillsides overlooking the bay, producing exquisite Chardonnays and Rieslings, while produce farmers and farmers' markets sold the freshest cherries, blueberries, asparagus, heirloom tomatoes, beans, and peaches. Farm-to-table restaurants had replaced dingy diners and smoky bars, and from Memorial Day through Labor Day, diners needed to gasp, make reservations. Lauren studied the simple scene in front of her, the lake at dawn, the dock jutting forth over the quiet waters, reeds rustling on the banks, swans waking, smoke from stone fireplaces and log cabins mixing with the morning light. And that sky, she exhaled.
That is Wade Rouse reading from his debut novel, The Charm Bracelet. And Wade, your earlier books, you're quite the memoirist. Confessions of a Prep School Mommy Handler, one of my favorite titles of all time. You also have At Least in the City, Someone Would Hear Me Scream, and that was about your move to Michigan. You're a regular contributor to People and Entertainment Weekly. You've been on All Things Considered. But this is your debut novel. So how tough was it for you to shift gears to write fiction as you tackled The Charm Bracelet?
You know, this book took me almost 3 years to complete, and my literary agent compared writing fiction to wrestling a bear to the ground. She said that, you know, you're going to get pretty scratched up along the way, but once you know how to do it, you'll be able to do it over and over again. I think that for me, this is a story that, you know, pardon the pun, jangled in my head for a number of years, but I didn't really know how to make it work as a memoir. So I jumped headfirst into fiction. And I have to say, I wrote this book, which is, you know, sweet and lovely and poignant, I think, at a time when fiction was becoming decidedly darker. And I really didn't know what the reaction would be to a lovely, sentimental family novel. And I've been really humbled by the result so far.
And what's your next project?
I'm currently writing a series of heirloom novels all based on my grandmother's heirloom items. So the next novel is completed and will be out next spring, and it's entitled The Hope Chest. And then I'm writing another novel after that entitled The Recipe Box, also based on kind of the recipes in my family and those things we cook that connect generations.
Wade Rouse, under the pen name of Viola Shipman, author of The Charm Bracelet. Wade, thank you so much for being with us today on Stateside.
Thanks for having me.
This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. The group hoping to legalize marijuana in Michigan is taking its fight to court and suing the state of Michigan. MI Legalize is hoping to put a marijuana legalization question on the November ballot, but state authorities rejected the group's petition drive because it didn't get the signatures within the 180 days spelled out by a law that dates back to the 1980s. The group is now suing the state to get the signatures accepted and get the marijuana question on the November ballot. Attorney Jeff Hank is the executive director of MI Legalize. Jeff, tell us about this lawsuit against the state. Just exactly what are you challenging?
Well, the most important thing about our lawsuit is to make sure that the signature of a valid Michigan registered voter on a petition counts. The situation is a little more nuanced, where in the 1970s, a law was enacted that dealt with validating signatures that are older than 180 days. That law was actually not enforced by the state of Michigan for about 13 years because the state's own position was that it was unconstitutional. And then in the 1980s and 1986, the Board of State Canvassers created a policy for how you go about rebutting signatures which are older than 180 days, meaning they count, you just have to go through a different process. Well, in the last 30 years, no one besides us has tried to do that. And when we approached the Bureau of Elections and Board of Canvassers on how you do that, they told us there was two ways. You either get everyone who signed your petition to sign an affidavit saying they still support it and are registered to vote at two different time periods, or you get local clerks to certify that these people registered to vote. Now, the problems with each of those two things, no one's ever actually done it. It would be impossible for us to try to get everyone, we're talking about more than 200,000 people potentially, to sign an affidavit. And the local clerks, which would have been our second option, either refused to do it, and they were also told by the Bureau of Elections that they don't have to do it. There was no actual workable process for us to be able to do this. So that brought us to where we are today, going into court, arguing that these two laws, the 1973 rebuttal presumption law, the 1986 Board of Canvassers policy, and the new SB 776 signed by Governor Snyder recently, which would restrict petitioning to a strict 180 days, those two laws and the policy are unconstitutional.
Now, Jeff, you knew the rules when you got into this. So looking at it from the Board of State Canvassers' point of view, why should they approve your proposal when so many others before were rejected for the same reasons?
Well, I don't think anyone's actually ever been rejected for the same reasons. No one has ever bothered to try this. You know, from 1963 to 1986, nobody had to put up with a rebuttable presumption. So campaigns actually went for longer than 180 days. It was only in these last 30 years where no one bothered to try this after this policy was enacted. And typically, one of these proposals makes it to the ballot and wins once every 7 or 8 years or so. So it's actually very rare. And typically, the people that exercise this ability are special interest groups that have the money up front that can actually afford to hire out-of-state contractors to come in and petition full-time and make it in 180 days. So we did know when we started that we had longer than 180 days to go. We didn't know that this policy would end up being unworkable. You know, we actually wanted to try to rebut our signatures with the clerks, but it's not feasible. We actually would have to send our petitions out to 1,500 different clerks around the state of Michigan, many of whom refused to comply with us. So we essentially had no way to do this, no workable way that would be accepted by the Bureau, and that's just unfair. If we actually have enough Michigan registered voter signatures on our petitions, all we're asking for is to give Michigan citizens the opportunity to vote on in November, and we think that's a perfectly, you know, reasonable expectation to have.
Help us understand, because most everybody listening are not attorneys, are there legal precedents upon which you're basing this lawsuit?
Absolutely. In fact, many courts have struck down out-of-state registration for circulators laws. For example, up until a couple years ago, there was still a law on the books in Michigan that said you have to be a Michigan resident to circulate petitions in Michigan. Well, those have been struck down all across the country as a violation of your First Amendment. This happened most famously in the John Conyers case a year or two ago, where he had out-of-state circulators that had circulated petitions and went to federal court and originally was kept off the ballot. But but ordered on. So, yeah, there is a lot of case law. There's a lot of case law regarding the retroactivity. We've asked that this new law, which sets a strict 180-day time period, not be applied to us. It was actually signed into law apparently just minutes after the Bureau of Election and Board of Canvassers rejected our petition the other week. So whether that was coordinated or not, I don't know. But we believe we have very strong legal grounds for this. Historically in Michigan, people have always had the time period between gubernatorial elections to petition. So we have a very strong historical claim that this is the way it was. And just for a short time period in the last couple decades, in the entire relative spectrum of this, has this policy been enacted? And again, some of the state's top election lawyers testified that this was a hastily crafted policy. It wasn't thoughtfully created. It's never been enforced. In fact, no one's even ever tried to do it. So we believe we have real strong grounds. And again, this has become bigger than marijuana legalization now. It is about the rights of every Michigan voter to be able to participate in this process. So we think it's a very important case, and we're going to do our best to stick up for the rights of every Michigan voter.
And we know the Committee to Ban Fracking is also filed a lawsuit in the State Court of Claims to get its proposal on the ballot. Is there a possibility of the two of you coordinating efforts here?
Well, we've been talking to the Committee to Ban Fracking all along. We sort of led the way on this policy, and they came along and certainly contributed to the dialogue and trying to make things better. And we have two separate cases, but in many ways, many of our legal claims are the same. And I think having reviewed their lawsuit, that they're right. You know, they have a right to continue on to petition at least until the 2018 election. So we wish them the best of luck. But we have a different case. You know, we were the only ballot group that actually submitted petitions to qualify. So we're in a unique factual situation. And that all happened, again, before SB 776 was enacted by the governor. So the Committee to Ban Fracking has a slightly different case, but we definitely stand in solidarity with them and with any other group that wants to petition to get an issue before Michigan voters.
Jeff Hank is the executive director and general counsel for Am I Legalized, the group suing the state of Michigan to get its marijuana legalization question on the November ballot. Jeff, thanks for filling us in, and we'll be in touch with you, and I'm sure we'll be following this along with you.
Thanks so much. Appreciate it.
You live in a neighborhood that's had its share of struggles. It is your home. But to others, your home is a handy off-the-radar place to come dump trash and drive off, or engage the services of a prostitute and then head back home again. What do you do about these outsiders you call humpers and dumpers? If you're Jonathan Palmerville and Lisa Thompson of Detroit's Brightmoor neighborhood, you start by getting mad and then picking up a video camera and recording what happens next.
All right, tell me what we got here, honey.
I was driving home last night from work. Saw a brand new pile dumped here on Ridge. It was pretty dark. Someone was going through it with a flashlight. So I didn't stop.
Looks like they strewed it all over the place here.
Oh, they made a mess.
And let's go take a look and see what we have here. Maybe we'll find where it all comes from.
And that they do. And then this Brightmoor power couple returns the trash to the dumper and posts the video on YouTube. These camera crusaders are with us right now. Jonathan Palmerville and Lisa Thompson, welcome to Stateside.
Thanks for having us, Cynthia.
Your YouTube channel makes for some fascinating and thought-provoking viewing. And I'm wondering what got you, Jonathan, to the point of saying, you know what, I'm sick of this. I'm taking this trash back to the dumpers. And by the way, we're going to roll a video camera while we do.
It was simply bore out of frustration. I was tired of picking up condoms off my front lawn, picking up trash from people coming into the neighborhood that shouldn't be there and dumping off their refuse. That's where I decided, you know what, I'm going to start taking back the streets. I'm going to do that with a video camera. And here we are today. It just kind of grew legs and started walking on its own.
And Lisa, you keep that camera rolling as Jonathan picks things up and figures out where it might have come from. And then knocks on doors and unloads that stuff on someone's lawn. What are some of the reactions you've seen, Lisa, as people get busted?
Lots of excuses. Lots of, we didn't know, we couldn't do this.
Somebody said I paid someone else to do it.
They use that excuse a lot. If you can imagine it, it's been said.
What is that moment like when you know you've got them right there, you're talking to the person that dumped that stuff? What do you see in their eyes?
It's most likely fear the most thing. They don't want to get caught. That's the last thing they want to do, get caught doing any illicit activities. And when they see my video camera, that's when they really you see the fear in their faces.
Well, I will say, because I've watched a lot of your videos, you have an unfailingly polite, business-like approach to what you're doing. So you're not going in there looking to mix it up. What's the message you're sending to these people as you walk up to their front doors?
This is a community. This is where people live. And you know, I'm not trying to escalate a situation. I'm trying to get it to stop. And by treating people with civility, I think that's where we're going to change things. I could go out there and yell and scream and say every bad word in the world. It's not going to change their behavior. My hopes is to change the behavior, and they see where they're going wrong and what they can do to fix that.
Just to break this down for those who have not seen Jonathan's YouTube channel, he finds trash dumped in the neighborhood, and then off they go, breaking into the bags and identifying maybe from a letter or some. I've noticed you found pill bottles with names on there, and then return to sender. Let's take a listen right now as Jonathan gives a piece of his mind to one of these dumpers.
You know what you're doing is illegal, right? No, you're not. No, I want you to pick everything you just put out. Pick it back up and put it back in your truck. Have you seen me on the news?
Yeah.
No, you need to pick everything up that you just put out there, put it back in your truck. I seen you stalking the neighborhood. No. I know who owns this place. You are not doing this. You are not dumping here. You're about to go on YouTube, my friend.
So this one, you caught him in the act.
Yeah. It wasn't too hard. I was out actually mowing my lawn, and this guy he was coming up and down the street, and I'm like, holy cats, he's going to dump.
Now, this I can sense could get a little hairy, Lisa. Is there ever a point where you're like, oh, I'm not sure we should, or someone might turn on us in the wrong way?
Yeah. A lot of times I'm the person waiting on the front porch with the phone with 911 in my hand, just in case I hear gunshots, especially when he leaves our street, because most of what happens on our street. But yeah, when he leaves, it is somewhat of a scary situation.
What do you do about the ones you call the humpers?
The humpers. My target is the guys that are coming into the neighborhood, not necessarily the hookers themselves. You know, they got to live too. And I'm not trying to foster this ill will with anybody in the neighborhood. But these cats are coming in from Livonia, Redford, Sterling Heights, Garden City. They're picking up hookers, and they're doing their dirty deeds in front of our houses, in front of abandoned houses that are for sale in our neighborhood. Nobody wants to look at a house that has a dozen condoms thrown on the front lawn.
How do you know where they come from?
We're able to work with a lot of the news reporters, Channel 7, Channel 4. They have tracked down a lot of the folks. They haven't put any of that out there, but we know exactly where they're coming from.
And the same with the dumpers. How far have you had to go? What's the furthest you've driven when you found an envelope or some piece of ID?
Well, if you're headed south, it would be Romulus. If you're headed north, it has been Waterford. We actually got a dumping situation. The video is called
Storage Wars.
Storage Wars, yeah. Detroit edition. And it was two girls that had their storage unit sold out from under them. Somebody in my neighborhood bought it, decided they'd keep all of the relevant stuff that they want, and then trashed the rest on the side of the road. Not only that, that turned into a felony identity theft. And that's what we're trying to stop. You know, this information that's dumped on the side of the road can be used against the folks that may not even know that their stuff is winding up on our surface streets.
This jumped out at me because when I was a TV reporter in Detroit through the 90s, I remember going to the west side of Detroit, and there was a street off of Livernois that you couldn't get through. You couldn't drive through because of the couches and the stuff that had been dumped. And you talk to neighbors, and they said the same thing you did. These are people from elsewhere and coming and using our neighborhood as basically their toilet.
Right on. It's opportunity-driven. It's these folks, they see an opportunity. They think that, you know, that's the perception of what Braymore is today. Is this where they can come in, dump off their trash, pick up their hookers, pick up their drugs, and then take off and
head
go back home.
Go back home.
Mm-hmm.
What do your neighbors say about your activities? And I'm curious if you're noticing anything less as you're getting more attention for your video vigilanteism.
Hmm. We have a lot of family as neighbors, so that's kind of a...
But it runs the gamut. There's a few folks that they do not like that I am out there with my camera. They think it's illegal.
This is your neighbors now.
These are neighbors. And then there's the other folks that really help us out wholeheartedly. They come together. We have a call out system. So we'll go ahead and message out to the other neighbors, and they will do the same to us. And we come out together now. So we can make it a safe neighborhood, and we all respond to this. We're starting to grow a bit. Not everybody's a fan of what we're doing, but when they see the effect, I couldn't see why not. Why would they not like what we're doing in there? We're not just, you know, busting the dumpers. We're cleaning up their messes as well, mm-hmm. and we're getting it taken care of by the city. I think that's the best thing that we have going on right now is the partnerships that are being built within the community and the city itself.
What kind of partnerships are you able to build more and more now with the city?
Department of Neighborhoods have been very good to us as far as helping us clean up the stuff that's dumped off on a constant basis. We probably have about 3 dumpings that happen on a weekly basis within our probably about a half a mile radius from my house. So it's a lot of dumping.
Our ticket writer, all he has to do is watch Jonathan's videos, and he issues tickets without even talking to us. So,
yeah, we're able to issue tickets through the videos itself.
Right.
That's the partnership. The police love what we're doing. The community loves it, and people reaching out everywhere. I don't think there's too many people out there that is opposed to what we're doing here.
Absolutely. How long do you think you'll be doing this?
As long as it takes.
As long as it takes. I don't think it's going to subside anytime soon. In my neighborhood, we're looking really good. We've brought as clean as we've gotten in the last 20 years. What I want to do is actually branch out and help other communities to do the same thing. What I'm doing is not unique. It's unique to my neighborhood. But if you went ahead and did this type of activities in any of these suburbs that I mentioned earlier, they're not going to go for it. It's just the only thing that's unique about what I have going on is that it's in Brightmoor and not in Livonia.
Now, how do people find your videos on YouTube?
Well, you can go to my YouTube site. It's called Faulknut, Focnut.
And there you are. Jonathan Palmerville and Lisa Thompson, the power couple of Brightmoor, who are the Canberra Crusaders. We want to thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Cynthia.
And if you miss the show on the radio, it's easy to catch us on iTunes. Just search for Stateside. And while you're doing that, please give us a review. We'd really like to hear what you think. Today's Stateside was directed by Mercedes Mejia. Stateside's executive producer is Jolynn Stroth, and Stateside's a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.
Support for the next idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities. MichiganBusiness.org.